Up North News with Pat Kreitlow is a product of Courier Newsroom and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Yes, it will indeed feel like a ring of fire for all the candidates for the next 91 days or so until we get to the general election. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Luke Mathers, our producer, is here as well. We will visit with our friend Kristen Lyerly a little later on in the morning, too. But for now, we are simply reviewing the various results from primary election night across Wisconsin, where Mandela Barnes, the current lieutenant governor, is seeking to be the next U.S. senator if he can beat incumbent Republican Ron Johnson come November. Meanwhile, I don't want to say the surprise about Tim Michaels, but it was a race that many thought would be too close to call till later than it was. Tim Michaels has upended Rebecca Clefish, and so it will now be Tim Michaels going up against Tony Evers. And we'll talk about some more of the results in a bit. But first, I want to tip my cap to Dan Schaefer, who runs a great site called the Recombobulation Area. And, and his Twitter feed as well is just a fantastic insight into Wisconsin politics of all types, and written in an extremely approachable style. And I guess his writing must be pretty good, because I'm not in the New York Times this morning, but he is, with an op-ed that's all about Meet Mandela Barnes, the 35-year-old candidate working to oust Ron Johnson. Now, this in and of itself, if Dan Schaefer's column, I have not looked at this yet, if it's six words long, it will have already done a favor just by having this headline in. Again, the headline is Meet Mandela Barnes, the 35-year-old candidate working to oust Ron Johnson. I think one of the most recent headlines in the New York Times was something like, is Mandela Barnes too liberal for Wisconsin? The birthplace of progressivism, basically doing what they could to contradict themselves. But the New York Times works so hard to overcompensate so that they can't be called the liberal media, that if you're on Twitter, you really, if you're not already, you should follow an account called the New York Times Pitchbot, which is nothing but these both sides headlines. And some of the time, those headlines actually come to be in the New York Times. It might take weeks or months, but it has happened. So, just to have a normal headline about Mandela Barnes is already a win for the Times and for everybody else.
PitchBot is always one of those. It's very similar to The Onion, when you just kind of have to do a double take these days, where you're like, wait, is this a real headline or is this somebody being satirical? Because it is... they're hilarious, but it's also wild that, like you said, sometimes what the New York Times PitchBot account puts out there comes to fruition in the actual New York Times.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of those things. As we see it, we'll share it over the next 90 days or so. But as I said yesterday, in my never-ending quest to circumvent paywalls and see if I can get in trouble with the New York Times, I'm going to share with you some chunks of Dan Schaefer's column, and then you should go get the rest of it yourself. Take it in, have a subscription if you're, one of those subscribing news diet people the way that I am. But Dan writes that, and he basically rounds this in Barnes as a generational change in terms of being a nominee. He begins by saying millennials came of age at a time of crisis. They are the first generation in American history positioned to be worse off than their parents. Their economic trajectory forever altered by the economic meltdown of the late 2000s, as the ladders to the middle class were pulled up or broken by the crushing burden of student debt, the decline of unions, and skyrocketing healthcare and housing costs, and as rapid technological changes proved calamitous, more so than democratizing. Mandela Barnes understands the challenges this era has thrust upon millennials better than most in his position. Serving under Tony Evers as lieutenant governor, Mr. Barnes is just 35 years old and, if elected, could be only the second senator born in the 1980s. Compared to how many senators, Luke, are in their 80s or claim to be in their 80s, but I'm pretty sure Chuck Grassley and Dianne Feinstein are in their 90s, if not older. I haven't seen their birth certificates. I don't know, but we have We have such a need for generational change. And I'm going to go, I'm just going to say on a tangent about that. And then we may or may not get back to Dan's column here, but off we go on another one of Pat's tangents. And this one about generations. My generation gave us Scott Walker. My generation gave us Tim Michaels. My generation has given us so many people who, when we were growing up, I felt like I had to explain to them that Alex P. Keaton, the Michael J. Fox character on Family Times, was a parody. You didn't actually want to be that. Much like the generation before, sometimes it had to be explained that Archie Bunker is a parody. You don't actually want to be that. But enough people in my generation embraced Reaganomics so strongly and still do, even though nothing has actually trickled down, you know, since Reaganomics first came on the scene, that because of this development, I was all in on Pete Buttigieg when he launched his campaign. The more I saw of him, the more I thought, this is what we need. My generation, I wanted to root for people like Kamala Harris, who's only a month older or younger than me, but there are too few of us, and there are a whole lot of people of Pete Buttigieg's age, of Mandela Barnes's age, who get it. I mean, they really get it. And they're in their mid to late 30s, and the people that I know around me in their mid to late 30s are so much smarter than we were, so much more savvy, and they have been dumped upon far more than we ever were. And they're more than ready to take the reins. So we'll find out more about what Dan had to say about Mandela Barnes's campaign a little bit later. But first, we will take this break. I'm Pat Kreitlow. You're up north.
The ring of fire, and it burns, burns, burns. The ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Just because we get the irony is not lost on me that we're playing a classic generational song by the Baby Boomers when it is the Baby Boomers and people from my era, which would be the very earliest of Gen X, who have really not lived up to their potential. And so we started talking about Dan Schaefer's excellent op-ed in the New York Times today about what he sees in Mandela Barnes and the generational shift that is apparently due. It's not going to come from Gen X. Gen X brought us, you know, young Reaganism that is now, you know, firmly entrenched in power. And it will be up to, you know, millennials who are coming of age next. And that's where, again, they have experiences that we didn't have. My generation has said plenty of times, and not joking at all, thank God we didn't have cell phones back then, cell phone cameras, social media, because, you know, our fun times from our youth stay right up here in our head, where we can embellish or bury the stories as much as we want. The people running for office now face nothing like that. I mean, I remember cabinet nominees had to withdraw because of rumors they once smoked marijuana. And that was it. They were done. Now, it will not be untoward, not that far down the road, if a candidate was discovered, you know, male or female, that, you know, there are naughty pictures of them, because that's the era we live in with camera phones and texts and tweets. We've already seen people who have lost jobs because of tweets they made when they were still in their late teens. You're going to see less of that as we've normalized social media, because it is real. It is what we are really thinking. These are the pictures that we are really taking. And the millennial generation has seen things that horrified us, that we never dreamed of. The plague of school shootings. I mean, you saw Columbine, we were mortified. Can't imagine we would let that continue, but Republicans relentlessly blocked any efforts to do anything about the gun crisis. In fact, made things worse by allowing the assault weapons ban to be repealed. We've seen what happened since. A whole generation, now an entire generation, has seen what has happened to their classmates, either the ones they directly know or the ones that they know about. And now they have seen a pandemic. And they have watched as their parents and grandparents have gone to war, not to keep them safe. Their parents and grandparents have gone to war against the safeguards meant to keep them and their teachers and others from getting COVID. So they have seen experiences that are going to make them unique candidates. So to go back to, you know, Dan Schaefer's column, Mandela Barnes has the tools needed to overcome some of this. He may be able to tap into a new pool of Wisconsin voters. The fault lines in American politics are sometimes generational as well as ideological, Dan writes. And that is certainly part of the story unfolding, where Senator Ron Johnson faces now a Democrat roughly half his age. Barnes is more than a decade younger than any of the other swing state Democrats running this year. And he quotes another writer who says the older guard now in charge lacks any sense of urgency and crisis, any sense that our system is on the brink. Now, Democrats have been delivering wins of late, the Inflation Reduction Act, and more that President Biden and Congress have accomplished lately. But what a process to get there, stalled by filibusters and parliamentarians and everyday D.C. gridlock, Dan writes. Mr. Barnes, for his part, he says, seems to grasp what the old guard does not. Barnes has put eliminating the filibuster front and center in his campaign and has throughout his career talked about the need for Democrats to be more bold, both in their messaging and on bread and butter issues. As a young Black millennial from a tough part of a large Midwestern city, he can give voice to issues that many in the Senate cannot relate to through his lived experiences. Barnes is the son of a United Auto Workers father and a public school teacher mother. And Barnes, of course, has his flaws as a candidate, which are going to come with that generation. He was photographed once holding a T-shirt that said, "Abolish ICE." And Ron Johnson and others are going to try to make a thing out of that. Here should be the comeback to that. Don't give people reasons to want an Abolish ICE T-shirt. You know, we can relitigate what ICE has done over the years plenty. Maybe it's not happening right now. But when that slogan and those T-shirts were coming out, if those are fights that, you know, Republicans want to relitigate, that's okay. Then you will find out why an entire generation of millennial voters does not consider that to be a controversy, but instead taking the bold stance that they are looking for. So Dan Schaefer's column in the New York Times goes on to, you know, point out more of Mandela Barnes's generational experiences, how he can deliver a new kind of message that speaks to the anxieties of younger generations and also harnesses their hope. And that if he can bring in just a few more votes that, you know, some older candidates would not bring in, then he can become what Tammy Baldwin is in the Senate. Somebody who was initially seen as too liberal, too urban from the big city of Madison. And now, you know, she won re-election handily because she is being seen for who she genuinely is, not the boogeyman that the right wing wants to make her and Mandela Barnes out to be. On a state level, we are still dealing with some of that old guard, which brings us back to our friend, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, and his close personal friend, Mike Gabelman, the former state Supreme Court Justice. We played in the last hour a little snippet of Assembly Speaker Voss reacting last night after winning his seat after an intense Republican primary, and how Gabelman endorsed his opponent, even though Voss was the one that gave Gabelman this rather cushy, well-paying job. And Luke, you brought to my attention that Voss had more to say about his close personal friend, Mike Gabelman.
Yeah, the first clip we played was from WTMJ4. Pretty much immediately as Voss was declaring victory, he was asked a question about Gabelman, and he, with kind of dead eyes, said, "Oh, Gabelman's not going to ruin my joy." And I thought that was hilarious. But this next clip is from WISN 12 in Milwaukee. And a reporter was following up after, it seems like Voss was leaving the party. It's in the parking lot of where Voss's viewing party was last night. So this is what Voss had further to say.
He's an embarrassment to the state. I hired him on recommendations thinking that we were going to have somebody who was a good, articulate, independent voice. It was very clear in all of our discussions that he had a budget that he set for himself. We didn't say go here and don't go there. He set his own parameters. Then we asked two simple things. Don't get involved in politics, and please try to make sure that you focus on the investigation, not being on TV. He couldn't help himself but to try to inject his own opinions into this race.
This was not a surprise. I mean, Mike Gabelman didn't come out of nowhere. He was appointed to the state Supreme Court, he became a lightning rod immediately. I'll have to go back on the appointed versus elected.
No, he was elected. See, I thought originally he was appointed as well.
I was thinking of Dan Kelly.
Correct.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes I get my right-wing white justices mixed up from time to time. Gabelman ran an ad against the incumbent justice, Butler, Lewis Butler, a black man, that was so over the line that he should have faced ethics discipline over it. But the court split because there were still enough right-wing justices on it. But all this is to say, Gabelman was a known entity. He was already known to be bombastic and brash. And so even when he was first announced by Robin Voss at the state Republican convention in 2021, his very opening remarks made clear that this was not going to be some kind of an impartial, nonpartisan investigation. So Robin Voss should not be too surprised to find out that, you know, somebody is biting the hand that has fed him hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, in expenses and salaries and whatnot.
And Robin Voss he completely glosses over the fact that he wrote Gabelman a blank check to do whatever he wanted for the last year. He's like, he set his own budget and just like glosses right over that fact that the assembly gave him more than 600 grand. To start, and now they're up to like 1.25 million, I believe, after the most recent legal bills. And so he had this huge cost to the taxpayers to go do this. And Gabelman was also, after the 2020 election, was speaking at rallies trying to overturn the results to believe that you had a nonpartisan, impartial, I hate using the I word, investigator. For this charade is just ludicrous. And the fact that there doesn't get more follow-up from some of these reporters interviewing him last night on that topic is a little upsetting to me.
Well, but as we now know, he is going to call a caucus meeting for next week where all of the assembly Republicans will gather. And, Voss is, I think, hoping that they will pull the plug on the Gabelman investigation. But it might go the other way. And, you know, you might end up with a new assembly speaker designate by the time all is said and done. But, you know, that remains to be seen as you watch a party that can't help itself. It is still stuck in 2020. It is still in a doom loop, basically. And if you don't believe me, look at the press passes that were given out at Rebecca Clefish's election night party last night. A couple of reporters put up their badges, and the badges have, you know, Rebecca for governor in big letters. Then in the middle, it says primary election night. And down at the bottom, it says press, you know, Conemaugh, Wisconsin. And in the middle of all that is the date, August 9th, 2020. Not 2022, August 9th. 2020. They are so stuck. They cannot escape. It is a trap of their own making. And it's where apparently they're going to stay for the foreseeable future. So we have the lighter side of that, of being stuck in 2020. But and to continue that, I want to talk about Tim Michaels, what turned out to be his victory party. Because all I saw of Rebecca Clefish's was, you know, one area where she was speaking, and of course the press pass. Tim Michaels, on the other hand, was somewhere, and I don't know where this was. I just know I saw a photo of it on Twitter. Reporter Emily Fannin put it up, and it's some kind of a church hall, dance hall, civic hall, whatever it is. It's got the wood beams going up top. You know, a very triangular high roof. Kind of a chandelier, but not, you know, like a fancy chandelier hanging down. And then you've got the tables, the stand-up tables that are, you know, wrapped in crepe paper. And then you've got some other little lights and decorations in there. And I did not see a victory party. I could right there looking at that. I could smell the roasted chicken. I could hear the little chicken dance being played. I could see the grand march, because that hall has probably seen more weddings than you can count. And I thought, this is the one. Whatever Tim Michael Stafford decided on this, I'm going to give them credit. That is the one good thing they've done so far in their primary campaign, was picking a classic, a quintessential Wisconsin hall to hold their party. And frankly, again, if the Michaels team will take my free advice, just do all your commercials and everything from right there. Make it look as Wisconsin as possible, and people might forget that you're actually from Connecticut. We'll take a break, and I believe Dr. Kristen Lyerly is going to join us for the rest of the show here, talk more right here about election night and the general election to come. I'm Pat Kreitlow. You're up north.
Here we go. From Lake Wasota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Joined by somebody from the other corner of the state, over in the northeast corner, we find one Dr. Kristen Lyerly, who has co-hosted our Wednesday night show during its run, and now will join us on Wednesday mornings quite frequently with Kirk Bangstead of the Minocqua Brewing Company. But if there's one thing that boy from Stevens Point likes to do, it's surfing. And I am sure he is somewhere surfing right now. Not something I would recommend that you do in central Wisconsin, so you got to go away to do that. Kristen, how are you?
I'm great. Good morning, and good for Kirk for being out surfing. You and I, Pat, we share some feeble joints, so maybe surfing isn't the best thing for the two of us.
You know, I was going to talk to Luke about that. We had the example of somebody jumping a Brewers outfielder, jumping to make a great catch last night, and I can only wonder what jumping feels like anymore. And, you know, I don't know. And I love just watching Luke laugh at this stuff, because I used to when I was his age too, you punk, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Pat, but the Tyrod Taylor one was great. Like they called it a pogo stick, and I was like, no, he didn't look like a pogo stick. And then I watched it, and I was like, yeah, pogo stick is the best way to describe that jump.
Oh, I totally see it. I'm just saying that there are many things I miss about my youth, and my knees are tops on that list. I really mm-hmm. miss them. And Kristen, forgive me, but I know you had some work done on a leg or both legs. So you're running on some bad wheels too, right?
Yeah, both legs. But you know, it is what it is. And at least I can walk and ride my bike, and that's the important thing. But can I just like pivot to Lambeau leaps? Because, oh, sure. You know, I mean, we're talking about
You were there Friday for the family night, right?
I was. It was such a joy. If you've never been to Packer Family Fun Night, it is such a beautiful event. The tickets are cheap, and you see families coming with little kids. Like you wouldn't spend $100 to take your kid to a real game where it's mm-hmm. kind of intense. But right. You know, you can bring your toddler to a game just to get a sense of what Lambeau is like. And it's people move about pretty freely in the stands, and it's just a practice, so everybody isn't really focused on the field. But you know, some things are happening. So we were over in the end zone, the south end zone, and at one point there was a touchdown pass, and one of the rookies ran over and he looked at the wall, and you could tell he was thinking like, do I do it? Do I take the leap? And he stutter stepped, and then he did. He jumped up into the crowd, and the crowd just went wild. And I think that is one of the greatest traditions in football.
So he made it. So he made the leap successfully.
He did. Which some people need assistance, you know.
I was going to say that has not always been the case. And I don't know if there's a highlight reel or a low light reel, but yeah, there have been a few people that have tried it, couldn't quite make it, you know, needed a little assistance, a little extra pat on the butt from the fans.
But it's a high wall. Well, remember Mason Crosby a couple of years ago, he kicked a really pivotal, not that all of his kicks aren't pivotal, but he kicked a really pivotal game winning field goal, and his team ran down and like scooted down and boosted him up so that he could make the leap, because you know he was maybe a little bit more like us.
What qualifies for a Lambeau leap for me these days is just getting in bed. If I can climb up and get there, it's been good for me. But you said you've gone back to riding your bike riding motorcycle too, right?
No,
just bike. Okay. So I didn't know how much you just finished a tour around summer, all of the Great Lakes. I didn't know how much of that was biking versus vehicular.
Yeah, I just like to drive places and bike, or like yesterday. So I'm in De Pere, so just south of Green Bay, and I just wanted to go for a ride. So I looked at the map and I found a little place on the map called Champion, which I'd never heard of before. It's like 20 miles away from where I live. So I biked up to Champion through some of the most beautiful farmland. It was a stellar day, and the crops and the sky and the red barns. I was just in awe the entire time. And then I got to Champion, which is an intersection with a sign that says Champion, but you know,
that was there cool. A bar there?
Was there a bar?
Yeah.
I think there is some sort of a supper club kind of thing, but
okay, well, that's close enough. Again,
whether, you know, it was still functioning.
If you have a name at a Wisconsin intersection, even if it's unincorporated, I mean, if it's got to be there, where, you know, where my wife grew up on a dairy farm, the intersection there was called Cato, C-A-T-O. And yeah, it was two bars on opposite corners, a little post office and a church. I mean, that just checks all the boxes. You're right. In Wisconsin, right there.
What else do you need? Yeah, perfect.
We've been talking earlier about the election results from Tuesday, and I'm noting some of the Madison reporters have heard from Governor Evers, who went out to breakfast with his new running mate, State Assembly Rep Sarah Rodriguez. And apparently the opening remarks from Evers about Michaels was, quote, Trump owns him and he owns Trump. So obviously Evers is not afraid to tie Michaels to Trump. It is what it is. You know, Trump did not win in Wisconsin in 2020. He probably would not win in 2024. Evers was asked about Voss narrowly surviving a Republican primary challenge, and Evers said, quote, he has got to fire Gableman and get over the last election. The governor's already come out swinging. So we'll talk about that a bit. I should ask if I have not met Sarah Rodriguez. I don't know if you have, Kristen.
I know Sarah well, actually. I did a commercial for her a couple of
weeks ago. Well,
Sarah and I ran. We were rookies running for assembly together in 2020. Of course, she was one of few people who were able to flip her district down by Milwaukee. And she is an extraordinary person and was a perfect candidate, obviously. She's a nurse. She's a small business person. She is determined and fierce. And she's going to be an incredible lieutenant governor.
Well, that is fantastic, because again, you know, the lieutenant governor, you know, the office is what you make of it, which, you know, some people think that's a bad thing, but you also have essentially a blank check almost to you know, to make it something, so long as, you know, the people above you in the governor's office, you know, aren't pushing back too hard. It's one of those things, to be honest, I've kind of wondered about Kamala Harris since becoming vice president. I did think that we would see more of her, that she'd be a bit more active on things, because you've seen other people like Rebecca Clefish, like Barbara Lawton, you know, when they were in number two positions of lieutenant governor, I mean, you saw them everywhere. They really made something of it. And I definitely get that impression. And then Mandela Barnes did the same thing. He headed up a task force on climate change. So I definitely get the impression, Kristen, that Sarah Rodriguez will not be some shrinking violet if she is elected with Tony Evers to the lieutenant governor spot.
You know, there's another thing about Sarah that I think is really important to point out. She is a former CDC epidemiologist, and that really gave her some street cred in 2020, which, of course, was the middle of the COVID pandemic. So I think what she brings is something we desperately need here in Wisconsin and all over the country, which is common sense, facts, evidence, science, all of that stuff that we believed in before all the craziness. We've got to pull it back in that direction. And I think some of the results that we saw with the primary really showed me that we are coming back. To see Ramtin's numbers so low, I mean, my neighbor has a Ramtin sign up. I've seen more Ramtin signs up here in northeastern Wisconsin than anybody else's signs. Mm-hmm. So to quell that crazy conspiracy theory piece, we're taking baby steps to pull our community back together and come back to common sense.
I think that it is a reminder that one of the things, one of the legacies of Donald Trump is that people who had what we would consider very fringe views felt emboldened. And that could be just holding a fringe opinion that's not based in fact, or it could be, you know, as extreme as, you know, violent anti-government rhetoric. But regardless, you had people that, previously would be properly chastised, chided, maybe even mocked, but instead said, like, alternative facts. Kellyanne Conway said, I'm allowed to believe this, even if it's not necessarily true. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I've heard lately, the past few years, somebody saying, well, I don't know, but it's what I want to be true. And that's not how this is supposed to work. And Tony Evers, of course, coming at it from an educator standpoint, has always talked about, letting science and facts point in the right direction for sound policy. So he's got to think it's awfully nice that he's going to have a lieutenant governor running mate who's also pretty big on science and facts.
Yeah, and she is really charismatic. And you really get a sense from her, as a woman, she is a woman who knows how to lead. She is confident and positive and is all about, bringing people together. So I think she's going to be a great pair for Governor Evers, which, by the way, have you seen his latest ad about not being flashy?
No.
Oh, it's so cute. Listen, folks, I'm not a flashy guy, but I'll always do the right thing for Wisconsin. It's just so him. I mean, I love him.
And that's what always has worked for him, is just stay on brand. Don't try to be something you're not. And what he is, again, in that mainstream of people who don't necessarily want something, that's far to the fringe. They may have right of center, opinions, but that doesn't mean they're going to necessarily go for the person on the extreme right wing. And that helps us transition to the state attorney general's race, because that one is going to have some very stark contrasts, some very divisive issues, with Eric Toney going up against Josh Call. We talked already this morning about, what Eric Toney did as Fond du Lac County District Attorney to put a woman's life through hell, charging her with felony voter fraud for making a mistake on her registration. So we've got what will surely be battles over election integrity, but then we also will have battles in that race about abortion rights, reproductive health rights, and, gun safety issues as well, and, red flag laws and universal background checks. And so, Kristen, as somebody who has provided abortion care and reproductive health care for women for, many years, that this is something, and as I've talked to candidates, it only keeps getting reaffirmed. This is not something where, women and the left of center population got a little upset and then things are going to revert to the norm by the time November goes around. This is not going to be that kind of a year.
No, absolutely not. And I think that's one of the things that Kansas showed us, the way that things went down in Kansas with the referendum, people are starting to recognize that the abortion issue is not how it's been packaged for political consumption, but actually abortion is part of a much bigger issue, which is politicians intervening between patients and physicians, politicians making decisions for you about your own healthcare when you are the only one who can really make those decisions. So it'll be interesting to see how this continues to play out in states like Wisconsin and South Dakota and Ohio, all of these states where people really fiercely believe that they deserve to have this autonomy. Of course, everyone deserves to have bodily autonomy, but when you frame it differently than the way it's been framed over the last 40 years, I think we're going to have a different political outcome.
Well, yeah, because we're no longer in that whole crafted narrative, about, that the anti-choice people have framed. It has now been made real. The narrative frame is much more real now of what real women are experiencing already with prosecutions, with persecutions, and with threats to further infringe on their own bodies. And that was the vote in Kansas. It wasn't a bunch of, women and men saying, we're pro-choice all the time. They were saying, you can't go that far regulating our bodies.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about abortion or contraception or starting a new high blood pressure pill. I mean, everything is kind of lumped in here. When you are telling somebody that they can't get a certain medication, but that medication is the thing that their doctor thinks is the best thing for them, it's frustrating. And it really has a giant impact on your life and your ability to live. So this, I think, is going to be the pivotal thing that is going to play out in the midterms. And we have what? How many days till the midterms? 90?
91, apparently. Yep. Yeah. So we're going to cover a lot of ground over 91 days here. And, you know, I think voters should buckle up. There's going to be more messaging than ever before. The amount of outside money that's going to come pouring into Wisconsin is going to be, shall we say, impressive. And the messages won't be, you know, all that kind. But, you know, we will find our way through this together, you and I and all the folks that we're going to talk to over the coming weeks. Kristen Lierley is joining us for the rest of this hour and the next hour as well. And we will talk about more of the results. And surprise, surprise, Donald Trump was supposed to testify in a matter this morning and refused. We'll talk about that more coming up next. You're up north. What is this? It's every 80s song you've ever heard. Everyone, I dare you to identify the song just based on that alone, because it could be everything. It could be the Breakfast Club. It could be all of them. It's Olivia Newton-John.
I am trying so hard not to sing right now.
Are you sure that's not Pet Shop Boys? No, it's Olivia Newton-John. It's every 80s song. Kristen Lierley joins us this morning as we're talking about election results, and we'll get back to that and other matters. But you know, you are in that age group, which is a very, very large age group of people who, if you're really young and don't understand the fuss about Olivia Newton-John's passing, I guess that's your marker of that you're below that certain age. But you know, to a whole lot of women, it's not like she wasn't necessarily the first at a lot of things, but she did so many different genres and styles well that I can certainly see why you and so many others, you know, really appreciated or emulated her growing up.
Well, and she was beautiful and she was sweet and she was like, she was so many, like you said, so many different things. Even like in Greece, you know, she was Sandy, who was like that sweet little Sandy. And then she was the saucy Sandy at the end.
She had that naughty side. And then she started doing physical and so many.
And then Xanadu, and I bought leg warmers. I mean, there's a whole thing happening here.
You still have the leg warmers, don't you? You still have the leg warmers.
Okay. I roller skate on occasion.
Okay. All right. Luke, make a note. We'll be doing a roller skating theme show before too much longer here. Speaking of people who are legendary for being sweet and attractive and kind and versatile, Donald Trump refused to answer questions in court this morning in a civil investigation over his business dealings. New York Attorney General Letitia James was seeking a deposition, coming just shortly after the FBI executed a search warrant in Mar-a-Lago. Trump put a post on his teeny tiny social media account that says, "Under the advice of my counsel, I declined to answer the questions under the rights and privileges afforded to every citizen under the United States Constitution." What would his reaction have been if, say, Hillary Clinton had put out those exact same words? It should be a rhetorical question, but, you know, I'll put it to you anyway, Kristen. How do you think he would have sounded off about that?
He is just, there's one thing that he is brilliant at, actually two. One is working the legal system and finding all of those little cracks that he can seep into to exploit them and exploit common sense. And then the second thing is marketing. He can sell anybody nothing. He is just brilliant at that, but that does not serve us. So like, his great skills are things that are terrible for humanity and obviously for democracy.
Well, it's been the delaying in legal proceedings he's a master of. Yesterday, my poor wife watched me, you know, just react in disgust when I saw an update, a headline somewhere on a court case ruling against Donald Trump, as happens all the time, but ruling against Donald Trump yesterday in a court case revolving around Congress demanding to see his tax returns, which, you know, he is obligated to do. There is no wiggle room in the law, but because he has made a legal case out of it and is dragging it through the court system, this has taken years and years. And as I said, I think just yesterday, the refusal of him to release his taxes should have been disqualifying. There shouldn't have been a single Republican voter who looked at that and said, well, we don't know. We don't know the whole story of his finances. But like you said, he can drag this out. He's now dragging out this thing here. He posted as well, you know, when your family, your company, and all the people in your orbit have become the targets of an unfounded, politically motivated witch hunt, you have no choice. Banana Republic. He's got Twitter Tourette's, basically. He will just blurt things out. Witch hunt. Banana Republic.
Oh, the last time I heard Banana Republic, it was Mike Gallagher on January 6th.
Right.
If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
There it is.
Oh!
There it is.
You know? When you have your staff taking the Fifth Amendment, taking the Fifth, so they're not prosecuted, I think it's disgraceful.
You see, the mob takes the Fifth.
Thank you, Donald. We appreciate that. I guess thank you, Luke, too, for having that at your fingertips. But you know, thank you, Donald, for making that clear to us. What our expectations should
only,
be.
Like, I just don't understand how somebody like Howard Dean can be brought down by a squawk at a campaign rally, but Donald Trump can do this over and over and over and over again. Like, what is it going to take for people to just disattach from him and actually start recognizing the damage that is personally being done, not just to this country, not just to our government, but like to us personally?
Look, there are many things that mystify us. I'm thinking as you bring that up, I thought I would turn to you again as a healthcare provider and ask about voting against a cap on insulin prices. As I've said, Ron Johnson and other Republicans could have voted for that amendment and still voted against the final bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, which we will ask Congressman Mark Pocan about tomorrow morning. But I mean, have you heard any good answers to the question of why politicians wouldn't support a price cap on insulin, something that some of your patients need to live?
It just defies understanding. It's all politics, but people aren't paying attention. And I think that is on us to hold our representatives accountable. And we don't do that because we get sucked into those sweet little messages or sucked into I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat. And that's, we get lazy. So it's our obligation within this democracy to hold our leaders accountable for the decisions that they make. And you know, somebody who did that beautifully and recently was Jon Stewart. When he was advocating for this group of vets and these burn pits, I don't know if you guys talked about this legislation a couple weeks ago, but there was legislation to provide relief for veterans from some of the effects and to stop these burn pits that were happening off-site, where they would take all their garbage and burn everything. And then people were dying of these weird cancers and having all these chronic lung diseases. And they had this great legislation that everybody pretty much agreed on, which never happens these days. And it got through the Senate and it ended up going back to committee for like some sort of a little tweak, nothing major, and came back to the Senate after some other political loss had occurred for the Republicans. And a bunch of Republicans turned their votes around and then voted against this legislation that was against veterans. And Jon Stewart was so artful at recognizing that this was entirely political, that their messaging couldn't begin to explain what they had done or why they had done it. And they ended up having to turn their vote back around. And this has since passed the Senate. So I think there is a way to do this, but a lot of it is on us as citizens.
Well, I think as well, and like you said, to explain the way that you did just now, it's the kind of thing that takes a while to explain in a newscast, and you know, newscasts are you know, not really good at breaking down complex issues. So I'm glad we have an opportunity like this. Kristen Lierley is here with us for the next hour as well. We'll take a break and be back. You're up north.